All right, on this episode of V8 Radio, we are here with a world-renowned automotive designer and artist and the problem child in Problem Child Customs, Mr. Brian Stubsky. Brian, how's it going?
Well, thank you, sir. Pleasure. World-renowned? I don't know, man.
Well, I made an assumption there. I'm assuming that you are the problem and the problem child.
Oh, most definitely. My wife would agree. I'm sure my kids would agree. And I probably have clients that would agree to that, too.
Yeah, nice, nice. Okay, well, at least I got that right today.
Nice.
So, what's the latest, man? There's a lot going on. And you've been a busy guy this past week just looking at this Facebook artist contest show off. What is that all about? What happened this week?
Oh man, it was kind of weird. There's been this ongoing like a Facebook art challenge, and a bunch of artists got together and said what they'll do is post up a bunch of their work, and as each one posts work, each day you post three pieces. You do this for 5 days. And each day of that 5 days, you pick another artist that you admire or someone whose work you like, and you nominate them to post theirs and do likewise.
That's very cool.
So it was very cool, yeah. A guy I admire and I consider a good friend and an absolutely phenomenal artist, Mike Learn, had kind of tagged me to do it. So I figured, well, if he was going to tag me, I would, you know, take that, run with it, and bring out some guys who maybe people haven't heard of, you know, or don't get enough credit or time in the limelight. So it was kind of fun that way.
Sure. Well, what I thought was neat was every day, you know, we got to see, what, three or four or five pieces from your portfolio. And in typical fashion, it wasn't just, here, I did this, here, I did this. They all had kind of a theme together. And then we saw some stuff that was completely off, you know, the genre that most of us know you in. You know, just more like a regular artist, which was pretty cool, not just automotive stuff.
That was the fun part. You know, I figured I'd take it a little bit further because I had seen that everyone was kind of staying within their comfort zone. So I figured I'd take mine just a little bit outside, you know, maybe show a few things that I do that, like you said, people aren't too aware that I play with. I had considered doing some of my writing pieces, but I know how that goes when you post anything like that. You always get, oh, that was too long to read.
Yeah, you know? Right. So. That's not a picture.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was cool. Got to see some new stuff. And the people that you recommended along the way, I also found myself becoming fans of and liking and looking forward to their stuff, too.
Outstanding. I'm glad you did. They were, you know, it was really fun to kind of pick someone. And you're sort of put on the spot where you think, man, you know, I didn't want to play a favorites game, and I didn't want to just give something where I was like, hey, I'm going to grab the same guys that are always posting. I figured I'd take someone, like I said, just a little bit outside that maybe people hadn't heard of yet, because there's some wickedly talented people out there. It's fun to share that stuff.
Yeah, that's an understatement. And I do think it's cool and mind-boggling to me to see that, you know, I've been kind of following your Facebook page for quite some time, and it's not a constant rehash of the same stuff. I mean, you've got a lot of work.
Well, thanks. I know sometimes it's tough, like when you get into a time of year like we're in right now, where it's a lot of proposal work for SEMA projects and things like that, stuff that I really can't show off. So sometimes you have to kind of go back into the archives. So I try to find maybe a version of something I haven't shown before. Maybe, you know, an idea that a client and I were kicking around for a while that never quite made it. And it's funny to revisit those sometimes because you find things that, you know, really would have worked out well. And in some cases, you know, it's kind of disheartening when you find out that somebody says, oh, I like that better than the actual car came out.
Yeah. Well, and then I guess there's some latitude maybe to change that a little bit or the color scheme or something and make it something new on its own.
Exactly. It's fun that way. I mean, it's, you know, the hard part is, you know, you get into your head where you want to entertain people every day. So, you know, there are times, too, I'll show something that might not be that exciting. So I try to find some way to put a twist on it. And it's always funny to me, too, the things you post that you think are going to be like a really big draw. People are going to say, oh, wow, that's great. It's awesome. Because, you know, you might maybe, you know, it's a piece that I love and I'll post it. And sometimes you hear crickets.
Yeah, right, right. Or the opposite is even more surprising.
Those are the fun ones. Yeah, it's the ones where I'm like, oh, I'll just put this up because I just want to have some filler up here today. And people go crazy for it.
Yeah, that's cool. And that happens a lot, I think.
So every now and then, you know, you get lucky. You get one where you get a bunch of likes on it, and you go, oh, and you feel good about yourself. And you get the other ones too, where you feel terrible because you think you're a failure. You're like, oh, four people like that one.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess if you put something up that four people like, you can always rely on the fact that, you know, you're cutting edge and you know, someday they'll get it. It's still good. You know, it's just not there yet. Not
expected. You hope.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's really cool. So you also alluded, and, you know, we're going to break all format here and talk about something you can't talk about and can't see because it's audio. But you mentioned some projects you're working on currently that you can't show yet. And I guess that's because, you know, it's not approved. It's not public knowledge yet. It's a car that's a super secret. I mean, what's the story?
Exactly. Yeah, I've got a couple on deck that I should say, that is heading to Detroit this year. It's actually in the trim shop right now, which is, you know, when you think about last minute stuff,
yeah,
you start to go, man, you know, you're a month out from Detroit and you see the car sitting there with absolutely no interior in it whatsoever. Maybe a couple of mocked up panels.
Well, sure. And of course, we're talking about a Riddler contender at this point.
Yeah. And hopefully I think this car really has the potential to go grade eight. You know, it's one of those projects that was near and dear to my heart when it started. And, you know, some of these go on for so many years, they become like your kids.
Yes.
You're almost raising them, you know?
Yeah. And the rules on the Riddler Award at the Detroit Autorama is that the car cannot be seen. It's got to be debuted there. So you can't show any build photos, and you certainly can't show the design rendering until they unveil the car, right? That's the deal.
Yeah, you can get away, these days you can get away with a few build photos, as long as it doesn't show, I guess, the letter of the law is the complete vehicle. So you can show bits and pieces of it.
Okay.
I know you got cars like Foose is putting together that Imposter.
Yes, yeah, and we've seen, actually now that I come to think of it, seen quite a bit of pictures of that one.
Quite a lot, yeah. So, you know, if you're like me and you're piecing them together in your head and going, you know, just picking the thing apart and going, this is like the coolest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And I've already seen it in my head. I know where it's going, but at least I think I do. They'll probably surprise us and do something really cool.
Right. Well, that's what they do over there.
Exactly. And, you know, but you get a few projects, you know, where I can't talk about them because they're either SEMA proposals. And a lot of those, you know, when you do those cars, it's a lot of product development. So you're trying to find, you know, a new way to do maybe ground effects for a car, mm-hmm. a new hood, something like that. And everybody wants that stuff kept secret. So it's, you know, the bad part is it's really neat stuff that I kind of, you know, I get into because, you know, it's a new car. But on the same token, you're throwing, you know, really different kind of ideas at something. And especially in the case of, say, you get like a tuner style car that we're throwing a real different twist on.
Sure.
Stuff I'd love to show, but we can't quite yet. And usually those we can show after, you know, the shop gets the okay and they're about 2/3 of the way through the build.
So this concept of keeping something secret before like the official unveiling launch, what do you think? Does it require that impact, or does the teasers along the way just kind of help build the excitement?
It's for me, it's almost 6 1/2 dozen of the other. You get into it where it's kind of neat to build, you know, you build on that secrecy because people want it. You know, if you can't have it, you want to get your hands on it. So it's really good as far as marketing goes and building hype. And I think if you play it right, especially today with social media the way it is, I mean, we're light years from where we were, you know, go back 10 years ago, if you're doing a SEMA rendering, you know, everyone's, don't show this to anyone. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, who are you going to show? Someone who walked into the office.
Right. Show your neighbor.
And say, you know, and say, hey, look what I'm working on. But, you know, today I think it's kind of funny because there's so much competition out there. And a lot of shops, I think, fear that, you know, scrambling for a unique idea in a sea of so many people doing something unique, it's hard to come across, you know, that one idea that's going to put you over the top. The fear is, I think, that if someone else sees it, they're going to copy it and rush to get it out before you get a chance to.
Yeah. And I'll agree with that. It's funny. I have kind of mixed feelings on that because in some ways I don't really mind copying an idea so much because, you know, like you were saying before, it's really hard to come up with something new and different. And I think that one idea, chances are, like, in the big cars that we build in our shop, we certainly try to make that integrate with other ideas that work together. So the whole thing is a package. And if you took the wheel or the hood or something, it's not going to measure up to the rest of the car unless you took all the elements.
Exactly. And, you know, I always looked at it, you know, when I was in school, you'd get quotes from artists and things like that. And everybody always quoted like Picasso with, you know, good artists copy, great artists steal. And so you find things that, you know, and I really think, especially in this business, you tend to take inspiration from something. Mm-hmm. And it's not really stealing an idea. It's, you know, maybe you pick up on one styling cue from a car and you say, oh, if I apply that in this way to that car, it suddenly becomes something unique and fresh.
Right.
And you know, but on the same token, you see a car where everybody did the exact same thing. I mean, I would hate to be in a situation where you see two shops that showed up with almost the identical car.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, even so, maybe I'm too close to it, but when you have two shops that have the same stuff, you know, it's like the two actresses, the two models in the same dress. One always looks better.
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
There's always one that did the rest of the details or did it, you know.
But you can always tell which one probably came up with the idea.
Yeah.
Because it's so much more well thought out. And like you said, you know, there's that other detail someplace else that picks up that cue and takes it further.
Right. You know, and I think a good example of this was, I guess, back in the early 90s when we were starting to see flush glass appear. You know, people trying to do that. And you'd have a car that looked like it was built in 1976, except it's got flush glass. You know,
exactly.
This was a last minute forced thing as opposed to a car where all the handles are smooth and everything is, you know, everything else is flushed.
Right on. And it's messed up that way. I mean, you can get, and sometimes you get a guy who's hooked on one detail like that too, where, I mean, I see it on that side where I'll get a client who comes in and they'll say, oh man, did you see, you know, this car, we'll just use the flush glass thing because it's great, you know, it's a great example. Say, this car had flush glass, and you're thinking nothing else on your car is ever going to make that work. There's nothing to complement it.
Right. Exactly. And it's a, you know, it's a 29 Ford that's all stock except for the windshield is now flush.
Of course.
It's revolutionary. Yeah.
And nothing beats it. You know, you get like, it's 56 Ford with a Continental kit. It's all squat in the back and everything's pure 50s style.
Right.
Except for, you know, the flush glass and, right. You know, the modern, you know, the new GTO bucket seats and everything like that.
Yeah. No. You need the Silverado seats with the built-in headrest and the seatbelt.
I'm going to bring that back. I'm working on that.
I didn't know it left.
The early 80s, kind of like the brome seats with the pillow backs. Those are going to be huge next year.
I tell you what, man, every once in a while I'll see a car for sale on eBay or an auction or something. Recently it was like a 77 Lincoln that had like 600 miles on it at Barrett. And it was the powder blue and, you know, it was a mark with the half, you know, Landau top and the whole thing. But that interior was like, it was like a velvet womb. You know, it was like, oh my God, I just want to crawl in there and never come out. And I thought, boy, I hate these cars. But now all of a sudden something happened and I wanted to go drive it just to kind of be isolated from the universe. I don't know.
There's that weird spark of nostalgia sometimes. You know, you get in a car and you go, man, like, especially until you look at it, you go, look at all the wasted space on the dash.
right. You know? Yeah, well, my dad was into Lincolns, and when I was a kid, one of my best friends, his dad was a sales manager at a local Lincoln dealer, so he had dealer cars all the time. So I grew up in town cars often, you know, and my buddy's dad would bring home a different one every week as a, you know, just a dealer demo kind of thing. And I remember, you know, really enjoying being in those because we could have full-on, you know, WWF wrestling matches in the back of the car going places. And then I kind of thought, well, you know, I kind of rebelled against those things. It's like, yeah, these are, you know, old man cars and they don't handle and everything else. And now it's kind of like, I wouldn't mind getting in something and just getting out refreshed and not cramped into one space because, you know, the seats are too articulated for handling well, which I love. But, you know, you drive cross country and it's like, I have bed sores, you know, now sometimes.
Exactly.
You think,
That's like one of my cars that I have on my list to build. I want to do like a, around like a 77 Olds Delta. I want to build one of those so bad.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as a kid, I had a 79, and it just, it was a beaten up rot box, but I loved that car.
Yeah, you know, that's another one. Funny you mentioned that. And this is a perfect example of how we don't plan this show, by the way, because these topics go anywhere. But again, when I was a kid, you mentioned nostalgia. The very first brand new car I ever sat in was a 1978 Oldsmobile Delta 88. And it was a silver two-door with a, you know, the red, kind of the blood red velour interior. It was a 403 Olds car, and it had whatever the, I guess, super stock two kind of design, you know, Oldsmobile steel wheel at that point by 78. But the thing that I remember most about that car is, I mean, I'd been to car dealerships and the auto show and everything else, but this is the first one, you know, my neighbor bought this car new, so I was in it a lot. And it was my first experience with new car smell. And I have noticed over the years that new car smell has changed so much from what it used to be.
I was going to mention that's, you know, that's funny. I mean, I my dad had worked at a dealership, so, you know, you'd go in on weekends and stuff like that. And, you know, you kind of sit in all the cool cars, and at least, you know, what I thought was cool at the time.
Right.
And yeah, that smell has really changed.
And when you start to dissect what that smell was, and it's, you know, probably cancer-causing spray glue to put the seats together, and, you know, CFC foam in the seats and everything, and a lot of plastic and rubbery stuff that you probably is illegal to manufacture today, and that's why it's different, you know.
No doubt. And, you know, I started to notice it, you know, I worked in dealerships growing up, you know, put yourself through school, and it was funny, like, I noticed that it always seemed like foreign cars had a slightly different new car smell than an American car had. And it was always weird that way. And, you know, even today, though, like with my wife's Chrysler, you get in that car, it still has that nice new car smell. And it's a little more, I don't know, it's a little less overpowering than it used to be, I think.
Oh, it used to be full on. You'd open the door and you could smell it down the block.
Exactly.
The other thing I thought was interesting is, I don't know, I think it was Ford that started building cars in Mexico, right? Small cars, escorts, and maybe things like that. And those had a definite different smell. The Mexican stuff was like, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it was bad. It was just different from what, you know, I think. And I actually think that might affect the buying public. You know, you open the door and it's not what you're expecting. You know, who knows?
And that's it. I think people look for that smell, you know. It's kind of like if you walk into a new model home. You know, you got that smell of the fresh paint and the wood and everything like that.
Right, right.
And then you get, you know, sometimes people, you walk into another house and it, well, you know, it smells like an Armenian kitchen.
Yeah, which, you know, unless you're really hungry and you like that stuff, you know, maybe it's 8 in the morning when you're going for a bowl of Cocoa Puffs, it's not the smell you want.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know,
that'd be a cool topic for some time, though. I mean, just talk like, you know, all the different senses that you use when you pick out a car. I'd love to explore that. Maybe get a government grant to study that for a few years.
Yes, awesome. As long as there's an owl involved, I'm sure you'll be able to get a grant.
Oh, we can find a way to put one in there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The effects of new car smell on spotted owls. I think you're onto something. But, you know, that does. A friend of mine is. Now he's with Ford, but he had been with Chrysler for a long time, and he had been through a lot of their training, and he's in the sales and service side, but had been, you know, kind of inside to get a lot of the philosophy. And he was the one that pointed out to me, kind of the obvious now, but the concept of touch points. And it came when Mercedes-Benz or Daimler or Chrysler happened, and the Germans really forced the touch point concept onto the Chrysler people. And that meant anything you come in contact with has to be really, really nice. And that's a philosophy that we use in our own shop here. There's nothing worse to me than, you know, finishing up a restoration or a show car or whatever, and you go to open the hood, and the leading edge of the hood has a tape line or an unsanded drip or, you know, orange peel or something, and it's right in front of your eyes, you know.
Exactly.
And it gets back to what you're saying before, you know, when you deal with the details, you know, it might have the world's coolest hood, but if it's not finished around the edges, you know, one's going to stand out better than the other.
Exactly. And, you know, and I agree with you, too. I mean, I think there's definitely, and there's that tactile thing, too, where I know, you know, go to the car show, don't touch the cars, but, you know, we see people touching it, you know, and I think that that's a really important thing for people. You know, they see something, and if it's, you know, glass smooth paint, they want to touch it.
Yeah, right.
If it's a certain grain of leather, they want to touch that. And you made a really good point where, especially if you pay attention to those details where somebody's touching something and you have like the greatest ever grain and the softest feel on that steering wheel, that sells a car 1,000 times over versus, you know, the restored, you know, or semi-restored, cracked and beaten up plastic wheel that came with the car.
Yes, yes. Steering wheels, to me, have evolved as a topic because I never used to really care. You know, it was just like, yeah, it's a steering wheel, big deal. But you're right. You get into a high-end European car, and of course now the high-end American cars, and you grab the wheel and you got something in your hand, you know, and it's good leather and it's got a good diameter and it fits, and you can hold on to it. And when we're doing Camaros are the worst because the original GM steering wheel was spaghetti thin, and the reproductions are spaghetti thin and they're mushy plastic sort of.
Right.
You know, and they're never the right feel or shape, and it's just awful. And the one wheel that I never really liked, now I like a lot, and it's a real GM wood wheel on a three-spoke stainless, you know, center. We took one out of a car because the customer didn't want it, and it was aged pretty well, and we scuffed it and cleared it with automotive clear. And it's a big diameter, and now it's like glass smooth, but it had this really good feel. And I'm like, I like these wood wheels now.
Oh, yeah, I dig those. I mean, it's funny, too. I've got a couple cars on my board right now where we're doing wood wheels in them. Mm. And one has a decidedly European feel to it. And that just seemed like the only wheel I could possibly put into that car.
Right, right.
And fortunately, you know, client who's got a lot of good vision and, you know, I was thinking about it. I was like, and in my notes, I've got it written down. I said, I'm going to push him on this wheel. And sure enough, what does he send me a link to? The exact steering wheel I was going to tell him about. So
right on.
It worked out cool, you know?
So you had to throw that out just to argue with him, you know?
Well, yeah, I just, you know, I pushed a Pinto wheel on him. And,
right. Yeah, the 69 F100 pickup truck we've got in the shop now that we've put over a 2002 Lightning chassis and driveline. The customer was concerned with the steering wheel. It's got the original Ford wood wheel in it. So after a quick conversation, we're keeping that one too. And like I said, we're just going to clear it. And some of them, they're nice to feel the wood grain. In this case, if you, you know, it's almost, you just envision dunking the thing and clear and pulling it out. And it's got this really smooth feel to it. And it's cool either way. But it's something nice. That I never thought I would like. Again, growing up, those wood steering wheels were like, nah, that's not cool. But now I think they are.
I think they're awesome. And it's funny how you change like that. I mean, then again, there's some wheels out there that I'll never, I think, ever like. But
yeah, right, right.
There's some pretty ugly ones. But, you know, there's some really neat factory wheels if you take the time and, you know, cruise through the junkyard and you start looking at things. And I'm one of those guys where I go through and I take notes all the time. So I'm like, oh, that wheel's really cool. I'd like to use that at some point on a car.
Yeah. Well, and you live in a dry climate where they have junkyards with old cars, too, which is nice.
Exactly. I mean, it's so nice to walk through a yard where you're not, you know, dancing around puddles and trying to jump over small lakes and things like that.
Yeah, here, you know, in the Midwest, an old car in the junkyard is like a 99 Taurus. You know, that's...
Man.
Everything else is long gone, especially when scrap metal went real high, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Everybody cleaned up everything, so...
Oh, yeah, all the good stuff went goodbye, and... Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, well, I grew up back east, so... You know, we had a family friend who ran a wrecking yard, and they had a lot of older stuff at the back of the yard. Mm. So it was always kind of neat to walk back there and check stuff out. And, you know, God, there was a 53 Buick back there that a buddy of mine and I, we always had this plan. We were going to drag that car out and do something with it. And, you know, you don't realize at the time, you know, you're young and bright-eyed, and one day you go back to look at the car and you go, well, it needs all the floors, it needs everything on the body up to the lower molding, and
right, it's gone. Yeah,
it's, yeah, it had a cool roof, and that even that was starting to rot away. But, you know, out here it's different. I mean, you walk around and you can find all kinds of goofy little treasures scattered around.
Yes. I remember when I lived in Southern Cal, we used to go to all the yards in the Inland Empire. And I came back one day with a badge from a Hillman Minx that was in the junkyard. And I was like, this cool. is unbelievable. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. I still have a pair of Hearst Old emblems that I liberated from a wrecking yard when I was in my youth.
Yeah.
You know, I remember going, man, one of these days I'm going to put this on my car. And then you get to the point where like, I'm going to throw it on my car. And you think, everybody's going to call me stupid.
Right. Well, they ended up stuck to the lid of the toolbox, you know, and on the fridge.
Exactly.
Yeah. In fact, we found a Roadmaster estate wagon that we cut the badge up, and it actually was able to spell Oastie wagon. This is before
that's
the days
awesome.
Of 3D printing and being able to go to AutoZone and buy letters. You know, you had to make the stuff.
Nice. Yeah. That's my dad had a thing for years where he would collect any emblem he could that had his initials. So when, you know, like the Monte Carlo LS came out, you know, he's got a toolbox that's loaded with LS emblems. You know, he's go, man. And I remember for a while, everything he had around the house had an emblem on it like that. And I was like,
well,
you know,
yeah. Well, I mean, now, heck, his namesake is found under the hood of half the Camaros ever built now. How about that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't make too many BS models, though, so I'm kind of sort of on my own.
I don't know. You know, maybe that's the next thing at GM, the BS1.
That'd be awesome. Yeah, looks like a ZL1, but, you know, performs like a, you know, a little electric car or something. Like, this would
like
be cool.
Like a Chevette. Performs like a vet.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's cool. So at this time of year, kind of you mentioned getting slammed to go to Detroit. I also think, as surprising as it seems to see a car not finished at this stage of the timeline, when you're building a car at that level, you're also dealing with builders that can handle it. They're at that level as well. You know, it's not the local guy in the garage. You're usually dealing with some pros that can pull last minute stuff off. So I don't really get too nervous about it, having been through the SEMA crunch ourselves many times, but.
No, and you know, you kind of get over it. I think you become desensitized to it, where, you know, there are times where you see a picture of the car and you go, hey, when did you take that picture? Like a month ago? And they go, no, we just took it this morning.
Oh, right, yeah.
And I'm thinking in my head, you know, you kind of forget that, okay, there's a team of guys working there. So you forget, okay, you're looking at multiple hours. Yes. Me, I'm always thinking, okay, if that car was mine, I'd be going, nope, it's going to be Detroit 2016.
Right, right. Well, and the other thing, too, is the final assembly stuff, in theory, anyway, that car's been put together a couple times already. So it's really just kind of putting things together and not trying to figure things out, which is where the time goes.
Precisely. And, you know, and it's always funny, too. I mean, I've had cars where you're weeks out from its debut and you're still figuring things out, like thread color for the interior. You know, a fight will break out the last minute. The owner decides he saw a couch that his wife liked. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the interior shop is pushing for, you know, they want their piece of the action on it. You got the builder wants his piece. And as a designer, you know, in your head, you've always got to figure out that, hey, this is the way I designed the car from the beginning. This is the only way I can see that car.
Right, right.
And, you know, it's a lot of, you know, holding your tongue sometimes, and other times it's just all up battles on the phone. And those are very awkward to listen to sometimes.
Yeah, I can imagine. We've been lucky that we haven't had those kind of arguments. Yeah, you know, but again, SEMA is a different deal because it's not a judged show. There's not a big award that goes with the SEMA show. You know, if you're there, that's cool, but it's not like getting a Riddler trophy or America's Most Beautiful Roadster or something. So
exactly.
that pressure, you know, there's a pressure to get it done, but not necessarily to get it done with the intent of winning an award with it. I mean, sure, you want it to be nice and everything else, but I can only imagine, especially when, like you're saying, you start to get more people involved towards the end, and if somebody sees something and strays from the plan a little bit, that's when things can get sideways.
Oh, yeah. And, I think, you know, that was another good point, too. There's a difference between, you know, the regular, say, like the ISCA shows versus, like, the SEMA show. The SEMA show, I think people look at that as a way to make a name for themselves in one shot. Mm-hmm. So you get a lot of these builders that kind of come out of the woodwork, especially this time of the year, where you hear the pitch over the phone where they want you to get involved with this project and help out. and you know they're going to become the next big thing. And it's funny sometimes because you find some really huge talent out there that, again, nobody's ever heard of. And you're kind of shocked. You think, man, where have you been hiding? Why don't you take your stuff out and show it off? And, you know, you just know this guy's going to do something great. I mean, other times you get the guy who calls you up. He's been to the SEMA show because, you know, his buddies took him. Yeah. And now he thinks he's going to get free parts and everything to build this car.
He got the matching golf shirt so he can, you know, he was there.
Exactly. And it's funny. This time of the year is the most frustrating. And it's also, I think it's enjoyable too, because like I said, I mean, you deal with people. This gives me a chance to work kind of hand in hand with some guys that I only work with maybe once or twice a year. And we get to do some really cool stuff and think a little bit outside the box. But on the same token, you know, on the other hand, you got the guys who show up and it's like it's the march of the freebies.
Yes.
And it's insane. It's so hard to explain to people where you think, no, I don't think somebody's going to give you a chassis and a set of wheels simply because you're going to have, you know, the only, you know, 74 Monte Carlo there on a 4x4 chassis.
Right. Because you have an idea. And what people need to realize is there is no such thing as free. You know,
no,
not at all. And they're like, oh, yeah, I can score this and score that. And, you know, this car will be here and there. And, you know, they'll give me this and that. And it's going to be the greatest thing ever. And in their mind, they're thinking they'll end up with this super hot car and have all this stuff for free and be a big hero. And, you know, most people don't consider, you know, if you turn the tables and say, OK, put yourself in a manufacturer's place. This company makes product X and they're just going to give you one because they like you. No. They're going to give you one because it has to do something in return. And what we find, you know, having done a lot of television and, you know, video and cars and magazine cars and stuff, there are companies that it would be infinitely easier to just buy the part than have to do the 10 times return on investment exposure, you know, than that they might want. And that's not uncommon.
Oh, exactly. I mean, you've got to become, at that point, you go from just being, okay, the guy who's either building or owning the car to becoming a salesman. You've got to go around and say, you know, how can I market this in a different way? And it's so hard to explain to some people, too. You say, yeah, you're not the only guy approaching this company for X part. There might be 50 guys hitting this one poor rep, you know, for the same part all year long. And he's thinking to himself, okay, 48 of these applications put down that they're going to be in the same magazine, at the same shows, things like that. He's looking for one that's outside of the box that's going to open up his territory and let him sell some more parts.
Right.
And it's so hard to explain to people. Like, oh, it's just, you know, I get the parts, I show up at a couple shows, and I'm free.
Right, yeah.
And you think, man, no, it's a year solid of just hardcore touring and promoting that thing.
Well,
to get it out there.
The next element that comes into play is if a company's going to give you parts for a car, they might want to say in how this car looks. You know, they don't want their parts to look out of place or to be portrayed negatively. And if they don't like the design, now, you know, if you got 35 different free parts on the car with 35 different inputs on direction and design, you know, the chances of success on this project are rapidly, you know, going away, and you're going to be on the hook for all of it.
And that brings up you're on stuff. And that's a great way, too, to kind of explain to someone who maybe it's their first SEMA show and they see cars there, but they go, man, that's so overdone. Why would you do that? And you hit it right on the head. You have to make concessions along the way. So maybe on paper, when you saw that rendering, you're like, oh, this can be the coolest car ever. I can't wait to see it. And you get there and maybe it looks like a circus wagon. Yeah, right. And, you know, and there's a reason why that happened.
Yeah, it should be spitting popcorn out the back, or, you know.
And it's never just, you know, one or two guys from different companies. It's their entire marketing department getting into it. And then you've grown and it's exponential. There's, you know, 35 different hands in this car all designing it.
Right, right. And especially when you start dealing with newer or smaller companies that free part is more of an investment for them. You know, they really want to make sure they got a lot riding on it. So they want to make sure that it's going to pay off. So their influence becomes heavier and heavier. And, you know, like you said, next thing you know, nothing works. And then
exactly.
Everybody loses.
That's a bitter pill to swallow, especially if it's one of your first cars you're building.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of guys, they're like, oh, I'm going to make my name. And I'm thinking, no, you're going to make a name for the parts that are on it. And, you know, any appreciation for what you do is going to be in the pride you take finishing it.
Yes.
So, you know, it's one of those cases where it's like anything. You might not enjoy it too much, but I mean, you know, we all pay our dues somehow. And heck, man, believe me, if somebody came up and said, hey, we're going to give you a car and we're going to give you parts to do it, I think I'd have no problem with a few things, you know, selling out. That first part of sellout is always sell. So,
yeah, well, you know, the interesting thing for us, we've been lucky to have, you know, worked with a lot of really great companies that kind of get it. And I'll use Magnaflow as an example. We've had two or three cars at Magnaflow's outdoor SEMA display. And the funny thing about this is when we build an exhaust system in our shop, you can't see it. You know, 9 times out of 10, we tuck everything up real tight and there's no visual tips coming out the back and everything else. So, you know, Richard Waitis is our guy at Magnaflow, and I have these conversations, we'll be talking. He's like, what are you guys working on? You know, we're doing this, you know, this Cutlass or this Camaro, whatever it is. Yeah, that'd be great in our booth, you know, because you're using our stuff. Yeah, we are, but you can't see any of it. You know, so you don't know that there's a Magnaflow kit underneath there. And he always has a good point. He goes, yeah, but you can certainly hear it. You know, so, yeah. But the downside there is at SEMA, you get to hear it when you move it in and you get to hear it when it leaves. And the public's not there for either one of those. But, you know, they appreciate the whole overall car, and they're not a company that says, we need to be front and center, you know, with an exhaust system bolted to the roof so that people can see it. So, again, we've been lucky to work with those kind of companies, but a lot of times you can call them a mile away. It's like, oh, yeah, that guy got free wheels for that thing because, you know, they don't work on any car.
I always wonder if it was easier back in the 70s for companies, you know, to display something because you had, like, side pipes and things like that.
Everything was on display.
Yeah, exactly. Today, it's everything, you know, the kind of the whole build theme is always hide everything. So that's got to be tough, especially for stereo companies and things like that. It's
oil companies.
Oh, exactly.
You know, you don't know what's in there unless it leaks and it's a color, you know.
Now, that brings up a whole different kind of build, though.
Yeah, right.
Well, interactive display where people are sliding around. That'd be kind of fun.
Yeah, right. People with like ketchup bottles full of oil, you know, you just walk by and you get hosed with it. I do see, you know, SEMA is another perfect example of the opposite extreme where you can tell that the person who built this car just does not care. All they wanted was as much free junk as they could possibly get and just hose this thing down with free parts. They don't care if they look good together, if anything. And I think the whole mission, you know, for them is they'll get all this free stuff and then try and flip the thing later, which doesn't work because the car sucks. But,
oh yeah,
you know, I talked to a guy a long time ago, one of my first SEMA shows, so probably in the late 90s, and this car just didn't work. You know, I was trying to ask him, you know, tactfully, trying to learn, you know, what the deal was. And he's like, oh, yeah, well, they gave me this and those guys gave me that. And essentially, this guy had a whole bunch of parts that were given to him. So we just kind of put them all together and then brought it out to Vegas. But the weird thing that he said is, yeah, it doesn't really work, but everybody's looking at it. And I thought, do you really want everybody to look at that?
That's a mindset I can't get into.
Yeah.
On the opposite too, you got the guys who maybe went at it with the best of intentions, but they got rushed and maybe life got in the way, and you wind up with a build that is so third-rate quality-wise where, you know, you fear for it if they have to move it.
Yeah, right. Because something's going to fall off. And
yeah. Exactly. You know, it's always the ones where you see, you know, they've got the floor jacks under it trying to pick it up because the bags won't fill or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And again, I'm guilty of that too, because the first car we brought out there didn't run. It wasn't even wired yet, you know, and the Royal Sport Camaro we did for Royal Purple Synthetic Oil. It was a great car. We just flat out ran out of time, but we committed that we were going to be there with it. And, and we were, and, you know, people dug the car, and luckily for SEMA, it's not a driving event. So, you know, really didn't need to drive, and we certainly didn't tell anybody, you know, we didn't represent this thing as being a finished car. But, yeah, that was, it's hard to believe, that was like 9 years ago, and we had a daily build video blog going where people could watch the progress every night, you know, almost a decade ago. And back then, nobody knew to look for that kind of stuff, so we were kind of ahead of the curve. But
I'll say that's it's pretty impressive. I mean,
yeah,
you know, today some guys don't even do that. So, and I really think, you know, I'm surprised there aren't more of those now. I mean, you get some guys, they have a decent YouTube channel.
Yeah,
but it's I understand. I mean, you're going to spend a lot of your time marketing things. I mean, and it's kind of tough, especially with all the reality TV. You can turn it all day long and.
Yeah.
Well, I guess a build.
Right. You know, my take on it is when we had a small crew, we were building one car. Everybody knew the deadline. We knew the mission. And we decided to kind of bring people along and show them the ups and downs and how things kind of go. Today, I really don't feel the need to be in that kind of pressure pot drama situation ever again, you know, because. Again, like you were saying before, when you're trying to earn your stripes, you got to be there. You know, you commit to something, you got to make it happen. And we certainly do have to make that happen now. But now I'm not going to put us in a position where, you know, we're doing this for this particular event come, you know, hell or high water.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, that brings up that other side of it, too, where you could, if you rush a car out there, you could have a great name you're starting to build, and you show up there and the car's cobbled together. It's, you know, you can tell it was rushed. It's the build quality's low. I think that can do more damage to you than not being there.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But getting back,
it's tough sometimes. I mean, you sign that contract though, and it's like, hey, you've got to be there. Well, that can destroy you.
Well, right. Yeah. If you show up with something at substandard, then, you know, anybody that was involved with the project, they're not going to be happy either. So it's a tough one, you know?
That's a great way to blacklist yourself too. You go in there and they say, hey, weren't you the guy?
Yeah.
And
remember?
No.
Oh, I'll never forget talking to a guy with a tire company who had a list. And he's walking around and he said he's got, I think he had 20 some cars at the SEMA show where his company had provided tires in exchange for being at SEMA. And out of the 20 some cars, I think he found 6 of them.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. You know, and it's like all those people that, and I'm sure there's, you know, some stories where best of intentions and some just didn't happen. I mean, and that's life. And then there's others who had no intention of ever being there. You know, again, they're just trying to scam free stuff and whatever. And it's like that's not good for anybody.
No. And that makes it tough on the whole industry. I mean, it's hard enough, I guess, to trust people to begin with. And it's even harder when you're trusting them with money. So
yes, right, right.
You come into that and, you know, all of a sudden you're bred all this mistrust. And, oh, man, heaven forbid you're involved with that person, then you're on the list.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, so I guess the bottom line is that, you know, if somebody is using free parts as a currency, you know, to build your car or to get you stuff, it's probably not a good idea because, you know, there's so much more to it. Like I said before, nothing's free. You know, you got to make the commitments and make it all happen.
No, and that's just it. I mean, you know, this is, I think it comes down to you build a relationship, and like anything, I mean, granted, this is cars and this isn't really a need thing. This is more of a want thing and kind of a luxury. But I mean, you know, it's, if you treat it the same way you treat life, you're going to make it pretty far. Go out there, you treat people some, you know, with the respect you'd like to be treated with, and do your best to help, you know, bring somebody along. And I've been fortunate enough, I hooked up with some good guys in my time who kind of brought me up and dragged me along. And, you know, I keep trying to do the same thing where when I get a shot, if I can find talent someplace, I want to grab that person and bring them along for the ride because it's fun. And, you know, you can show them that, hey, this is a really kind of a unique brotherhood we have.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and you've worked with some of the best. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Ben, that's been fortunate, man. I still... I still get, I get goosebumps sometimes when you see a name come up on the caller ID. And it's kind of nice.
Yeah, IRS for one. That's
Hopefully not. That'd be a whole different kind of goosebumps.
Inverted.
Definite puckering sound.
Right, exactly. But I mean, getting back to the giant library of work that you've done, every once in a while I kind of cruise through your website and be like, oh my gosh, you did this car? You know, just things that I didn't even realize.
I need to update that someday too. That poor thing's neglected, but
yeah. Well, it's not like there's time for everything, for all this stuff too.
Exactly. I've been fortunate. I mean, I've gotten involved with a lot of really cool cars. There's been stuff that just kind of fell on my lap at times, and there's been other stuff I chased after to make sure I could get my hands on that project. And either way, I mean, it's really fulfilling to me because, working with some of these guys and seeing the things they can do. And occasionally, I mean, it's funny. I mean, I have fun working with anything from a project where it's a guy in a one-car garage trying to put together, his dad's 57 Chevy that he's had since 1988. Or on the other side, you get kind of the pie in the sky thing where you work with a shop like Rad Rides where you get spoiled in that way that that no matter what you come up with, they're going to make it happen.
Right. Yeah.
And, I'm always the guy thinking, okay, well, if we have this part and I'm going to make this, how would I go about building it? And it's kind of fun that way because you get to talk to these guys too. And, you're talking to the fabricator and at least you're, on kind of the same level where you know what the car looks like when it's apart. You know what you're dealing with. But then these guys will say, oh, no, you're thinking like 5 years ago, we can do this with it now.
Yeah, they can do anything. That's the scary part.
And that's really frightening because then you get off a job like that. And sometimes it's tough because I'll go from that to a really strict budgeted, and I want to say like, minimal tooling that the guy has at his disposal, things like that, where I've got to really kind of rein myself in and go, okay, we're going to work with everything you have here. And I'm going to take a little trip out at lunchtime to the wrecking yard and make some notes on stuff that's available, take some measurements and get you an idea of stuff we can use.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the other thing that can be frustrating when somebody has a designer do a rendering of a car that they cannot build.
Oh, yeah.
that's the bummer. And you look at something, it's like, yeah, I would love to be able to do a, 7/16 scale version of this 55 Ford, with glass and everything, because it looks awesome in the picture, but we cannot make this happen. And then what we make happen ends up not looking anything like that. And you go, oh, then everybody loses. We've been lucky that the renderings and designs we've had done in the past have all been, I'm not saying photorealistic, but buildable. And our finished car looked really, really close to it. And then everybody's been happy.
And that's been great. You guys work with some really talented guys. And, that's falls back on both them and you. It's the talent of the designer being able to get you something that can be built.
Right.
And it falls a lot on you, too. You did the research where you found a designer that could do what you needed to be done. I mean, it's easy enough to go on a forum and say, to type in, hey, who wants to do a rendering for my project truck? And, some guy comes out and now you've got this Chevy Love pickup with, a 58 DeSoto front bumper on it and all kinds of stuff that could never be done.
Yes. And you see that all the time. The, hey, who wants to do a rendering or who can do a rendering? The same way it's like, hey, who can wire in a 220 fuse panel in my garage? it's like that same. It's not the same,
And I mean, don't get me wrong. There's a time and a place and, everybody starts somehow, some way, but. If you're serious about the project, I'm always like, do research, go out there, find a guy that, or a girl, for that matter, there's some really talented girls out there doing it right now.
Oh, yeah.
And, that's great to see because it really opens it up that, there's a whole broad variety of people to choose from. But like, if you're out there and you've said to yourself, okay, I'm going to build this car and I like hearing this, I have $250,000 to spend on the car, but I only have $200 to spend on a rendering.
Yes. Yes.
And you kind of think, wait a minute. It's like, let's not put the cart way before the horse. Let's start figuring out, you need a plan first of all to spend that 250 grand. And, you know, if you're trying to get everything for free, well, this is going to be horrible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, but, I mean, so that's where the research comes in. You look at somebody's work, you talk to a few people, you find somebody you get along with who can share that vision, and you go with it. And to me, it's, I mean, granted, it's not quite as serious, but, you know, when you get into investment-wise, I equate it to, like, looking for a doctor. You know, you can go and find a surgeon someplace, you know, pick one out of the phone book, and, hey, this guy sounds good. But you're not going to walk in there and say, hey, I need this life-saving, you know, operation performed. What do you charge? And then go down in a back alley and find a guy who can do it, you know, for $30.
Yeah. It reminds me of the Bell Helmets had an ad in the 80s that said, if you have a $29 head, use a $29 helmet.
Nice.
But, you know, it's funny.
I think I talked to that guy this
yeah.
week.
$29 helmet.
That was
head.
Mean.
I got lucky in California, believe it or not. I was, when I first started working for Hot Rod, my office was on Wilshire Boulevard there in Los Angeles, and I needed to find an eye doctor, right? So how do you find an eye doctor? Well, California, Southern Cal is a very diverse population of people from every possible background and nationality and anything. And I developed a system where I found an eye doctor who had a name close to mine. So my last name of Ostie, I found a guy named Dr. Henry Oster, and he was right down the street. And I got lucky because this guy was, like, you know, on the board of international ophthalmological geniuses and everything else. But that was my strategy for doing that. I didn't go in the alley and say, I didn't approach a guy, though, and say, can you do this for $80 or, you know, $25?
Should have tried. You know?
Yeah, I should have, because, man, he wasn't cheap. He was good, though.
That's a really good technique. If I try to find a Polish doctor, though, chances are it's all just the beginning of a big joke.
And yeah, well, then you can start negotiating price with that guy.
See, nice. Hey, you're Polish, I'm Polish.
Yeah, right. Let's go make some music. But it's funny when you know, the other nice thing about the rendering process is, getting back to how buildable the car is, you know, people like to say, you know, I'm doing this so I have an idea of the car. But that, again, if you have somebody who understands how cars are put together and who's actually tried to build a few, then you'll be able to see that the details that are in that drawing can be done. And, you know, we usually blow one up into a poster size and just stick it on the wall in the shop and say, hey, build this, you know, and each department, you know, the mechanical guys or the metal guys or whatever, will use that as the reference. And every once in a while, you know, there'll be a question of, yeah, where's this stripe supposed to go? Because the body line isn't really here in reality as it is in the car or whatever. But that's where you got to kind of dance on your feet and pull it off. But
right on. And that's, you know, and it's funny sometimes. I mean, it's neat to see. I find that if you get a guy who does, like, super realistic, like 3D type renderings, those have their place because, you know, especially if the model's built right, you know, everything's right where it belongs. The proportions are right. Everything's perfect.
And you can spin it around too and look at the other side.
Exactly. And that's the great part about that. The other part is, too, sometimes you see a really stylized one where it just looks super cool. And those are great renderings, especially for selling a client on the project, where, you know, it's super exciting to look at and it's cool. And I mean, speaking for myself, it's been tough to kind of come out and find a balance between super realistic and just stylized enough to get people excited and jazzed about the project, you know, so that, you know, when it gets done, they don't look at it and go, hey, it looks nothing like your drawing.
Right, right, because it's a letdown.
Exactly. And I'm always afraid of that. You run into that sometimes with the car where you go, man, you know, we really tweaked the heck out of that rendering. The builder and I might be talking about it and saying, well, we'll stretch the nose just a little bit and we'll put it way down on the ground because that's what this guy likes.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my head, I'm fighting with it because I'm going, well, there's no way this car is ever going to sit that low.
Right.
You know, at least not with what we're doing to it. And then you start to think, well, if I make it that low, now I've got to try to find a way to modify the hood to bring the engine out of that. And it's a funny thing, but you're like, okay, it's going to serve its purpose. It's going to sell it. But then I always have this other page of drawings where I'm thinking, okay, in reference to the original drawing, and I'll have little notes all over it, like A, look at note A, and here's the drawing of it the way it should be.
Yeah.
A little more realistic. And maybe, you know, I've been told that's my problem. I obsess too much over that.
Well, I think what's insanely useful is when you have that dramatic, you know, because a lot of your imagery has movement and it's got, you know, exhaust and it's got light beams, you know, coming off the headlights and cornering lights and stuff. And it's really kind of alive. But then to also do some insets or another page where it's got a couple of details of, you know, well, this is how this works or this assembly kind of fits together in a more technical kind of diagram instead of, you know, a rendering.
Definitely.
And answer some of those questions.
And it's funny, too. I mean, I've, you know, you make enough connections around town where I'm sure sometimes they groan when I come in. But I've got friends who work in parts departments out here and in body shops. And I'll call them up all the time and say, do you happen to have one of these in the shop? You know, and that's usually no, but I know that these guys do. So you go down and I try to get in there. Sometimes you take a look at a car where I know it's been hitting a certain point and they're at, you know, a stage of either tear down or reassembly where I'm in there trying to get pictures of stuff to find out where, you know, a bracket is behind something.
Oh, sure. And, wow. That's impressive that you go that far.
Because I have this thing where I want to know how everything works. So, you know, when I come to someone, if I'm trying to sell them on an idea, especially something that they might not be too warm to at the beginning, where I can come at them and say, hey, look, it takes this bracket. It has to mount this way. I mean, we just ran into a weird situation on a project that I can't talk too much about. Mm-hmm. But it was one change in a model year on the headlamps that the owner had bought versus what we had spec'd out for the car. Mm-hmm. There was a total change in the bracketry and everything.
Sure.
And it just wasn't going to work. So I wound up redesigning the entire front of the car to use yet another headlight assembly that fortunately the builder had seen in a parking lot and said, hey, what do you think of these? And, you know, it was just one of those strange situations where I was like, well, I know exactly where there is a headlight like that. It's out in my garage.
Uh-huh. And you could kind of split the difference. And
exactly. It was kind of neat, you know. So getting into the technical side of it, I think, is more fun. You know, I get to draw the cool pictures. But I'm always trying to think, you know, okay, we're going to have these parts going into it. Here's the part number. Here's the cost on it. And here's what it's going to take you, billable materials and hours, to make that happen. And it's kind of fun to do that sometimes.
Well, you actually can kind of try and predict that, because that's the big unknown, is how long is it going to take?
Exactly. I try to get into it, and I try to ballpark it, and I haven't been too bad. I mean, there's been a few where you deal with a builder who maybe has never done anything like that before, and, you know, two or three different piles of unused parts later on.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, it's just so, again, when you're making something that didn't exist before, you know, how do you predict the time?
Exactly. And again, that's kind of that split between working with a place like Rad Rides, where you're dealing with guys who can build anything and they don't even look at it as I'm putting part A onto car B. They're just going, well, we've got to make this.
Right. This is going to happen. Yeah.
And it's really cool, you know, and it's especially fun, you know, that organic kind of back and forth where you think you've got a good idea and it turns out that maybe one of the guys in the fab shop has an idea that is 1,000 times better, mm-hmm. that grew off of what you started with. And then, you know, you kind of go back and forth and you start throwing ideas around for the details and things like that. And it's tough sometimes because in your head you've got to figure out that it's like, this is your baby. It's the car you designed. But these guys come out and they go, hey, you know, it kind of gets taken away from you a little bit. It's almost like, yeah. Like fostering your child someplace.
And I always felt bad for, in my mind, and I don't know if there's any truth to this at all, but growing up in the 70s and seeing the disasters on the street with the 5 and, you know, what seemed like 100-mile-an-hour crash bumpers and all the add-on chrome and stuff, and to think that somewhere there's a pure version of, you know, even something silly like a, you know, a mid-70s Pinto, there's a good design of that on somebody's desk that got federalized and it got crash, you know, safety built in, and it got add-on upsail trim and all this other crap. And by the time you get the finished car, it's nowhere close to what the original designer wanted. And I felt bad for that guy, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the hard part. That's the harsh reality of this whole thing. And so, you know, I think I've learned over the years, too, you go into it and you just accept everything is going to be what it's going to be at the end. Things are going to change. you know, the concessions are going to have to be made. It's terrible, though, when you see a car like we talked about earlier, where it just suddenly becomes this thing where, hey, this company's going to step up and give us wheels. So now the really cool wheels you had picked out for this car that worked really well, those are off the table.
Yeah.
And you're like, done. Okay, and that. And sometimes you can see it's the beginning of that downward spiral where you go, well, I don't like this car so much anymore. And I've had them before too, where it's mean to say, but you get at the very end and the final rendering for the car doesn't have your signature on it.
Yeah, yeah.
You just kind of leave it off. And
you provided your service, but that's, you know, that's about it. He who pays the piper picks the tune, is what I had a professor in college always say.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, being in your chair and being called upon to, you know, continuously, I guess, push the envelope in some directions, and in other respects, you're still doing images of cars that aren't trying to reinvent the wheel. What do you see? I mean, are we seeing more and more of the highly customized, you know, muscle cars or 50s customs, or are we seeing... You know, it seems to me like things are kind of going in a lot of different directions right now, but there's still room for some of the purest stuff at the same time. I don't know.
That's a loaded question. I think at this point there's room for everything. It's kind of scary too. Like you said, people have become far more open, especially with regard to a customized muscle car. And I think there used to be that almost like that stigma against it, where if you had a muscle car, it had to look like the factory car. And then you kind of drifted into, you know, obviously went through Pro Street, where everything got kind of tubbed out, but it still looked and retained a lot of the factory stuff. You move on to Pro Touring, and it kind of started the same way. It was just basically, you know, a dumped out car with better performing parts underneath it, but still retain that factory approach. And they started getting into places, you know, like guys like the Ring Brothers would step up and take it just to that next level. So customization started to become big. And I definitely think, I mean, no matter what, I don't think muscle cars are going to go away. I do see a lot of tubbed cars starting to come across my plate again. I think Pro Street is picking up. Mm-hmm. It's kind of scary in a way.
Well, but I think it's in the next evolution of Pro Street, where it's not all of the things that, you know, that I hated about Pro Street, you know, where you had to have the braided hoses and the blue and red fittings and, you know, the Mr. Gasket street scoop on everything.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, I think the days of like the recipe book build are over.
Yeah.
It's not so much now where, you know, we go through with every phase. I think custom cars went through it, where suddenly every car had to have, you know, just the same stuff on it. And it's destined to happen. I mean, somebody finds a combination that works and everybody else is going to pick up on it and run with it. But I think today it's a little freer. You can kind of take and bring in things from all different walks of life. Like there's a lot of architectural elements finding the way into cars, especially with interiors and things. I really think that, you know,
like what, like Corinthian columns? I mean, what do you mean? Flying buttress?
That could be a whole different thing. If the van craze comes back, I'm going that way. But now you see things like
the Vantheon.
Oh, yeah, see,
here we go. What,
there you go, SEMA 2017. You, me, the Vantheon. This would be awesome.
With
we need to do it.
With what's the cat, the giant, the Sphinx on the okay.
Hey,
we could mix Greek and Egyptian.
Greek and Egyptian, this would be genius.
The Egyptian pantheon.
Ooh, this goes along with what's happening this morning on the Facebook page, but we're not gonna
all right,
which I do apologize for.
Yeah,
but the no, what I see is like you get a lot of.
Wait, I got to write this down. Wait,
Van. I already wrote it. So
the okay, got it.
It needs to be. If we do this, though, it's got to be one of those cool like mid '70s Fords with the little the slant nose.
Yeah.
Now we're getting. Oh man. See, now you're gonna be thinking that.
It'd be alabaster white. You're easy to kind of push off course. It's fun. You'll be up all night now.
Oh, it's my day's over.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be date night with the wife, too, and all I'm going to be doing is going, we need to go someplace for Greek food.
Yeah, right. I don't know, what do you call that little squiggle Greek thing that goes around the perimeter? You know what I'm talking about?
I know. Oh, my gosh. Come on.
With, you know, and we could probably get, you know, like a Little Caesars to fund this project.
Ooh. So now we're bringing all kind of like Roman kind of thing. And
yeah. Yeah. Just ancient, you know, just all kinds of, just mix all the ancient civilizations together in one van. And
now we're getting, I can't, darn it. Now you got me thinking too.
Yeah. You deliver pizzas with them.
Did you ever see one of those? They had a How It's Made show where they were showing how they make this. It's like an on-site pizza, like vending machine.
Oh,
and
really?
It makes the pizza right inside.
So there you go. You just call up the Little Caesars Vantheon, and it shows up in front of your house, and you push the button, and it spits out a pizza.
I think we're getting someplace now.
Yeah. I think, you know, I know who could give us wheels. Oh, man. Right on front of SEMA. People would just walk up in front of the SEMA show and push the button and get a pizza.
This will be great.
Yeah, it's revolutionary.
Oh, my God. See, think about what a trend that could start, too.
Yeah.
It's not just a van. It's a history lesson on wheels.
Right. You could have an animatronic, you know, Caesar coming out. And you might as well put some pirates in it just for fun, too. Because it'll be at SEMA, so you could recreate the whole Vegas Strip with Treasure Island and the pirate ships and Caesar's Palace all right there.
And we do it like, oh, my gosh, like an old school Disney kind of attraction where, you know, maybe you sit down and you just get rotated around it.
Yeah, right, like the Hall of Presidents or the future, the Tomorrowland or whatever that was.
Right. Was it? Come on.
In the 50s, we'll have electric appliances and they got the cords all over the place.
This would be so genius.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. There was a wheel company at SEMA one year that had a rotating thing in their booth. What's the first year you went to SEMA? Do you remember?
Oh, my gosh. First year I went to SEMA, 2001.
Okay, so this, I think, was 97. And I think maybe the economy was more robust at that point because this company probably spent $250,000 or $300,000 on this booth easily. And it was two levels. And you'd walk in, and the perimeter had some couches and lounge tables and stuff. And then they had this bar. And you'd go up to the bar and sit on a bar stool. And if you weren't paying attention, the bar stool would knock you on your can because it was moving. It was a ring. And all the bar stools would carousel around the bar. And they would actually serve booze in this booth. And they'd give you a free drink. And then as you sat on the stool, the backside of the bar was like a Disney-like attraction with all their wheels on the walls. And you got a close-up look at everything. And there was cameras in the wheels looking at you. And the people outside in the display saw monitors of people drinking and looking at the wheels and doing stuff they weren't supposed to be doing. It was really pretty cool. I don't remember who it was, though.
That's outstanding. We see. Yeah.
Unfortunately,
we bring that back. This could be the greatest. We need to just, we make it, it won't just be like a part of the event or display. This will be like, you know, you will go there and you'll leave a changed person.
Right. Yeah. This is going to have to add a whole nother week to that event.
Did you see SEMA? No, I spent the first 2 days at the, you know, the Vantheon display. I got lost in the catacombs. It was pretty awesome. We can have like a shag catacomb. Picture this. This would be
the shagacomb.
We give you like a little black light to find your way through.
Oh no. Because you won't find your way through, but you'll find other stuff.
At the end, you can be doused with Purell. It'll be awesome.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Brought to you by Purell.
Betty, we have a water slide. You make your way through these catacombs, but you're slowly going uphill.
You're right. Yes. Another Disney-esque thing. You get to the top, and then there's a big chute.
This would be, but what do you ride down on, though? It's got to be something like maybe like a, it looks like maybe your little floaty thing looks like a beanbag chair.
Yeah, yeah. We got to find with people waving palm fronds from side to side on the way down.
Like a history of vanning, like the van and you.
Yes.
But it's got to be done. This is going so far off the rails. I apologize. Imagine it done like old school, like film strips, though, where you have the guy like, what is a custom van? And how can you identify them?
You know, the audio track skipping on the sprocket.
Bing. Simple. All custom vans have the following things in common. This would be awesome.
Ding. Shag carpet. Bing. Mural.
Porthole windows. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah,
right on. Well,
if you, this would be great, though. How can you see one? How can you find one coming around the corner? It's like, listen for Molly Hatchet to be blaring.
Yes. And look with your nose. You'll find a mixture of overly rich carburation and illegal substances and clouds.
I was going to say we could even have a whole area in there where it's like Epcot Center, but like it's done from like, you know, the biology of.
Right. The evolution.
The custom van.
Yes.
What the heck? We were talking about. Oh, boy.
I don't remember at this point.
I had
a van, though, man. I did. I had a 79 Dodge Maxi van that was a conversion. It was bad. It was, I was in high school. My dad bought this thing. He always wanted a camper, but didn't, you know, it was like, didn't have the discretionary income to get a motorhome or anything. And we used to have a pop top, you know, tow behind camper, and he just kind of wanted to combine the whole experience. So in the early 80s, he picked this thing up, and it was, you know, root beer brown with the orange to tan fades all over it, and murals of waterfalls on both sides, and, you know, the plush sculpted shag with a rust colored theme inside, with you know, the captain's chairs and a bar and everything. I mean, it was killer.
Nice. See, I wanted a custom van so bad. I still want one.
I'll have to put a picture of mine up on the site.
Please.
Yeah.
Please see that we're gonna. It's gonna become the Vantheon.
Turbine wheels that were stuck to the drums so bad we had to torch one off when we got a flat tire once.
Oh my god, Greek that Greek thing. By the way, it's called a meander. I don't know why I didn't even think about that.
Ah, the meander. Yes.
Think about it. That might have been the start of the endless line striping.
Oh yeah, you can have it evolve over the panels. Yeah.
Whoa.
I think we need to build two of them. We'll have the what the heck?
The Viander?
No. The Vantheon and the Meanderthal, and they need to fight at the end. We'll just crash them into each other to the death.
That'd be the way to end it, you know, the whole drive out for SEMA.
Yeah. Everybody that's leaving Vegas sees their own shadow from the explosion behind them.
that's what we were talking about. Speaking of evolution, yeah, there we go. It was, you know, where do you see stuff going?
Oh, hopefully not what we just described.
I want to see that now. If nothing more than to see, you know, the 136,000 square foot display this is going to require.
Yeah, man.
You know, come see us in what used to be Hot Rod Alley.
Right now it's the arena.
Well, we do it like that. Oh my gosh, we do it like a traveling display where it's like a mini coliseum.
Yeah, with gladiators.
This would be cool. Mm-hmm. And we can't, you know, feed people the lions and stuff like that, but I'm sure we can find something. Maybe. Mm. Here you go. We have the Little Caesars people. What we do, though, instead, we feed the pizzas to the people.
There you go.
Genius.
Right. And then maybe a little CG, you know, we can have some lions here and there.
Oh, yeah, we have, you know, so maybe you think you're being attacked by a lion?
Well, you know, like Katy Perry at the Super Bowl thing, you know, when she kind of comes out on the giant man-powered whatever that was.
People dressed like lions dancing around.
Right, yeah.
This just gets better.
Yeah. Well, I think what we should do is maybe we'll save the next chapter for next time. Because anybody that's still listening to this is probably going to need, you know, some kind of smelling salts at this point to
therapy. apologize for
both. All right, man. Well, that's cool. And if you you know, do a lot of any sketches of that, you know, make sure you share them.
Oh, now I'm to the point where in my head, this is how sad it is. I'm figuring out how to make time to fit this in.
I'm not responsible, by the way.
To the point where I'm going, well, you know, if I just have the kids cook dinner every night.
Right, exactly.
And that puts me X minutes ahead.
Yeah, please don't take away from worthy projects.
I don't, you know, that'd be horrible. Yeah, Brian deprives the world of another, you know.
Right, exactly.
Riddler grade 8 car, yeah, as if. But, yeah, that'd be awesome. Because, what did you do? I made these vans.
Right. Yeah.
I'll end up on an episode of Where Are They Now? I went downhill with a van.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's kind of what happened with society. We're finally kind of out of that. But.
Whoa, see? Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, this has practical applications. I want to see this as a permanent display in the Smithsonian.
I think it's also a at least a 2-semester college course now.
This would be.
As well.
I minored in Vanthian.
That's right. I speak Vanthian.
Oh, my gosh.
Or at least a T-shirt, you know, like a movie poster style T-shirt that's Vanthian versus Meanderthal.
Done.
Yeah, there you go. Easy way out.
Done.
All right, man. Well, listen, I appreciate the time. It was it went by too fast, I guess, but I didn't listen to it, so I don't know. So,
by the time you edit it out, you'll be like, well, there's 3 minutes of useful stuff.
Yeah. And Brian Stupski. Okay, thank you. Thanks for listening. But we will do this again. And if
awesome.
There's a button on varadio.com on the right, you can click and iTunes will automatically subscribe to the podcast if you want to. And we'll put some of those images up, definitely of my old van on the site. And if, you know, is there any renderings we can grab from yours and throw a few up just to show people that haven't seen your stuff?
I'll give you whatever you want. And, you know, and maybe we can update it later on with, you know, I don't know, a couple vans. But
you know, it's funny. I'm going to say I hope not, but secretly I kind of hope so.
I'm not trying to push that, Vans, but, you know, if you think of it, Vans, we could do those later on.
Yeah, Vans, right. All right, man. Well, listen, you have a fantastic day, and we appreciate the time. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Likewise. Thank you so much, man.
All right.
Pleasure.
See you, buddy.